This is CD 7 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains session number 7 titled Brahman.
This evening we're going to discuss three concepts that are very dominant in the Bhagavad Gita. The concepts are Brahman. We're going to introduce the idea of the Purushottama. And we're going to also, if time allows, discuss sacrifice and the way sacrifice works. Now I'm going to read to you not only shlokas from the Gita, but quotes from other beings, some of the poetic version of the Bhagavad Gita written by Ganeshwar, some of Ramakrishna's experiences about the Brahman. If you are aware of the predicament that, as Ramakrishna says, the one thing that can't be soiled by man's tongue, by words, is the Brahman, because it really can't be spoken about. We can talk about it, but we're talking from one place about something in another place that is entirely different than anything that is speakable about, so that there is a certain way in which we are at the point where language is denotative. We're just pointing to the place. The language isn't a substitute for the thing itself. It's merely pointing there. And so if you just open yourself to these different kinds of writings, you will start to get a feeling for what Brahman is about. There are two kinds of Brahman referred to in the Gita. One of them is the formless aspect, and the other is that aspect which creates form. And we are talking now about the formless aspect of the Brahman. It's as if when we went through the sequence before, and this is all still part of what's called the higher wisdom or becoming the man of vision, when we went through the sequence before, the feeling was, the understanding was, that as we extricated ourselves from identifying with body, with personality, with senses, and even with thought, and pulled back in and in and in, we came to the point within us, which we call the Atman, which was the spirit within the form. And that Atman is like the doorway through, or that part of Brahman, which is in each individual. And one of the routes through to the Brahman is therefore going back inwards, as Ramana Maharshi does with the neti neti, not that, not that, not that, pulling back in. And as you'll see later, another way is to go out. There are many ways to get to Brahman. One of the statements made in the Tao Te Ching, which I think most of you must be familiar with, the Book of Tao, it's apocryphal. I doubt if it's the way it is, but it's as good a way as any, that the keeper of the library, Peking, was going home to die. He's a very old man, and he came to the boundary between his home province and the place he was leaving. And the guards stopped him, and they said, "You have to pay a fee to cross this boundary." And he said, "I don't have anything." And they said, "Well, what did you do in life?" He said, "Well, I was the librarian." And they said, "Well, you go over and sit under that tree, and you write down everything you learned and leave that with us." So he did go over, and he sat down, and he wrote these 81 verses. And this one is verse number 14. "They call it elusive and say that one looks, but it never appears. They say that indeed it is rare, since one listens, but never a sound. Subtle, they call it, and say that one grasps it, but never gets hold. These three complaints amount to only one, which is beyond all resolution. At rising, It does not illumine. Its setting, no darkness ensues. It stretches far back to that nameless estate which existed before the creation. Describe it as form yet unformed, a shape that is still without shape. One meets it and it has no front. One follows and there is no rear. If you hold fast to that most ancient way, you may govern today. Call truly that knowledge of primal beginnings a clue to the way. From our Gita. When a man surrenders all desires that come to the heart, and by the grace of God finds the joy of God, then his soul has found peace. He whose mind is untroubled by sorrows, and for pleasures he has no longings, beyond passion and fear and anger, he is the sage of unwavering mind, who everywhere is free from all ties, who neither rejoices nor sorrows if fortune is good or is ill. His is a serene wisdom. When in recollection he withdraws all his senses from the attractions of the pleasures of sense, even as a tortoise withdraws all its limbs, then his is a serene wisdom. Even as all waters flow into the ocean, but the ocean never overflows, even so the sage feels desires, but he is ever one in his infinite peace. This is the eternal in man, O Arjuna. Reaching him, all delusion is gone. Even in the last hour of his life upon earth, man can reach the nirvana of Brahman. Man can find peace in the peace of his God. The man who sees Brahman abides in Brahman. His reason is steady, gone is his delusion. When pleasure comes, he is not shaken, and when pain comes, he trembles not. He is not bound by things without, and within he finds inner gladness. His soul is one in Brahman, and he attains everlasting joy. For the pleasures that come from the world bear in them sorrows to come. They come and they go, they are transient. Not in them do the wise find joy. He has inner joy. He has inner gladness. He has found inner light. This yogi attains the nirvana of Brahman. Holy men reach the nirvana of Brahman. Their sins are no more, their doubts are gone, their soul is in harmony, their joy is in the good of all. Because the peace of God is with them whose mind and soul are in harmony, who are free from desire and wrath, who know their own soul. When the sage of silence, the Muni, closes the doors of his soul, and resting his inner gaze between the eyebrows, keeps peaceful and even the ebbing and flowing of breath, and with life and mind and reason in harmony, and with desire and fear and wrath gone, keeps silent his soul before final freedom, he in truth has attained final freedom. And finally, the group of shlokas in the 13th chapter. Now I shall tell thee of the end of wisdom. When a man knows this, he goes beyond death. It is Brahman, beginningless, supreme, beyond what is and beyond what is not. His hands and feet are everywhere. He has hands and mouths everywhere. He sees all, he hears all, he is in all, and he is. The light of consciousness comes to him through infinite powers of perception, and yet he is above all these powers. He is beyond all, and yet he supports all. He is beyond the world of matter. He is invisible. He cannot be seen. He is far and he is near. He moves and he moves not. He is within all and he is outside all. He is one in all, but it seems as if he were many. He supports all beings. From him comes destruction and from him comes creation. He is the light of all lights, which shines beyond all darkness. It is vision, the end of vision, to be reached by vision, dwelling in the heart of all. In Hinduism, the expression that is used is Chitta Vritti Naroda. Chitta Vritti Naroda. The cessation of the turnings of the mind. The image is of an ocean on which there are waves, and the waves are thought forms, feelings, personality, worldly sense data, thought forms, ripples on the waves. And slowly these ripples get quieter and quieter until there is a vast, calm ocean out of which these ripples came and back into which they return. And that image is the image of Brahman. Now, the predicament of Brahman is that it looks one way from where we're looking from it, through at it, from our thoughts, and it's quite another to be within it. There's a beautiful story. Ramakrishna used to go into samadhi all the time, into very high states of samadhi, and he always wanted to share with his disciples what he was experiencing. So he'd say, well, now, when Shakti, when the Kundalini comes up and it gets to the third chakra, you experience this, and he described that. So when it gets to the fourth chakra, the Anahata, you experience this. When you get to the fifth chakra, he'd say, you experience this. And when you get to the and he'd go into samadhi. And he'd just be luminous and stand there and be, you know, somewhere else, right? And he would be differing from a dead man only in that he retained his physical life heat and the senses were available. Then he'd come down and he'd start again and he'd say, I guess the third and the fourth, and he'd go fifth, he'd go out again. And after three or four times, tears were streaming down his cheeks. And he said, I really want to tell you, but the Divine Mother won't let me. I just can't do it. It just won't come out. It just can't be expressed. From here, all of the statements that concern the entering into, quote, nirvana or nibbana are relevant to the entrance into the Brahmanic state. The blowing out of the candle. From this point of view, everything that you and I know as who we are falls away from our minds completely. And as long as there is stuff in you that pulls you into this world, desires, attachments, even attachment to knowing anything, then this state is elusive. You may be able to overwork with energy and to overload so that you get into a lower level of this experience where you get a sensation of what it might be like, but then as the wedding guest in the Bible, you get cast out again because you're not wearing the spotless wedding garment of no attachment. In a way, the validity for me of what this is all about has come through my psychedelic experiences, which I recognize as possibly only an astral analog of the real thing. But I can vividly recall back in 1962, 63, in a meditation room in our house in Newton, where Tim and I were living, taking LSD, and for 3 or 4 hours by clock later, there was no universe. There was no experience of no universe, and yet it wasn't empty. These are all paradoxes. Imagery I have, unfortunately, is that as the chemical overload wore off and my karmic predicament reasserted itself, rolling down the room was this huge red, blood-red wave which had in it all of me, little me, all of the images of who I was, and it was like a Hieronymus Bosch painting. It was a yiff. And I remember putting up my hands to ward off the re-entry, if you will, but I knew no secret mantra or no way to stop the wave, and it rolled in over me, and I could feel coming back into form. And before that, there had been just this peace in every direction and this feeling of the oneness of the universe. But even those words are not descriptive. They're just qualities that I'll talk to you about how they fall short. The meditation room we had was in the, we had put a false wall in the living room, so it appeared the room didn't exist, and you had to come in through the basement up through a ladder. And it was sort of in the middle of the house, and I climbed down the ladder when I finally got back into my body, and I went upstairs into the kitchen, and there was a woman who had just arrived at the house the day before, and she had come up from the south on a bus in order to get a job in the north. North. Very far out. And she had come to our house, and she was going to work at the house, and apparently she was sitting in the kitchen drinking a cup of coffee, and I came up from the basement, and she took one look at me, and whatever it was she saw blew her mind, because the coffee cup went flying, and she came running off. This was about a 55-year-old woman, very solid, straight, conservative, Protestant, came over, and she fell at my feet, grabbing my feet and kissing them, which completely freaked me, as you can well imagine, and drove me running out of the room. Later she said, when she came up, all she saw was golden light. So whatever that Brahmic state was about, it was coming through. It wasn't me, it was just, I was being used in a way to blow her mind, the way I understood it. In describing the Nirvikalp Samadhi of Ramakrishna, in that rapturous ecstasy, the senses and mind stopped their functions. The body became motionless as a corpse. The universe rolled away from his vision. Even space itself melted away. Everything was reduced to ideas which floated like shadows in the dim background of the mind. Only the faint consciousness of I, repeated itself in dull monotony. Presently that too stopped, and what remained was existence alone. The soul lost itself in the self, and all ideas of duality, of subject and object, was effaced. Limitations were gone, and finite space was one with infinite space, beyond speech, beyond experience, beyond thought. Sri Ramakrishna had become the Brahman. And Ramakrishna said, our attempt to go to Brahman to report back what it's like is like a salt doll, a doll made of salt, that goes to the bottom of the ocean to determine its depth, because obviously on the way it will become totally dissolved, and so there will be nobody to report back. And that was Ramakrishna's predicament. Gyaneshwar was this very interesting fellow. He wrote this probably when he was about, I think about 15 years old, and there was some dispute as to whether he was really a phony or not. And the caste of the Brahmins, the priests, came to test him, to check him out. And they were accusing him of being a fraud, so he had a buffalo that was standing in the courtyard recite the Vedas for the Brahmins. rather gross, but it was. And his writing is very poetic in his descriptions. Brahman is the object of all knowledge. That one, that object of knowledge, is out without beginning and is called the highest Brahman. As earth is visible in the form of clay pots and vessels, jars of every kind, so Brahman is everything and is in everything. O high-souled Arjuna, the Shrutis describe him as universal-eyed in order to indicate his all-pervading nature. Otherwise, any reference to his hands, ears, or feet is meaningless. It is of his very nature that he is without attributes. Similarly, as one wave appears to swallow up another, yet is the one separate from the other? So when there is in reality only one being, can it be said that one pervades and another is pervaded? Yet in speaking of these things, one must make such a distinction. When it is necessary to indicate zero, one must use the sign for not. Similarly, one has to use the language of duality for describing non-duality. O Arjuna, he is as the ether pervading all space and like the threads of the warp and woof of a piece of cloth. As the quality of moistness becoming water is found in water and the quality of light in a lamp. As the quality of camphor is in camphor, and as bodily activity manifests itself in a body. As gold exists in every piece of gold, so Brahman both is all and is in all. Gold in the lump seems to have all the properties of gold, yet though it is in a lump, it is still only gold. Ether appears to be round when enclosed in a pot, but square when it is in a house. But as ether does not cease to exist when the enclosing spaces are destroyed, all your attachments, so Brahman, though existing in form subject to change, does not undergo change. He appears to have mind and sense organs, also the three qualities, but as sweetness in a lump of sugar is not in its form, so these sense organs and qualities are not Brahman. Such modifications as name, form, relationship, kind, activity, and separation belong entirely to the outward form. Brahman is not the qualities, nor connected with them, though they appear to belong to him. Owing to this, the deluded man imagines they are attributes of Brahman. To think that they are so would be like believing that the sky is one with the clouds, that a mirror is one with the form reflected in it. Or that the sun is one with its own image in water, or a mirage the same as the rays of the sun which cause it. To impute attributes to Brahman is as foolish as saying that a poor man really enjoys the kingship he experiences in a dream. Brahman is in everything, both movable and immovable, as heat is the same in all forms of fire. It is within and without, near and yet far off. It is one without a second. As the sweetness of the ocean of milk is not greater at the center and less near the banks, so is this being the same everywhere. In the whole creation of beings of every class, it is without exception immanent in all. It is like the reflection of the moon, which is the same in every vessel containing water. Or the taste of salt in every grain of a heap of salt, or the sweetness in every one of 1,000 sugar canes. It is that alone which pervades the whole of creation. Brahma is the supporter of all forms which proceed from him. As the body passing through the ages of childhood, girl or boyhood, and woman or manhood is still a body, so he is unchanging through the beginning, the middle, and the end of creation. O dearest one, at the moment of manifestation, he is called Brahma, the creator. During the period of existence, it is called Vishnu, the sustainer. And when all forms are dissolved, he is called Rudra, the destroyer. And when the three qualities cease to be active in him, he is the great void. It is at the same time knowledge, the knower, and that which is to be known. And it is that by which the goal is reached. There remains no trace of duality, O Arjuna. Now, for our purposes, although it would be nice to continue the tennis match, from our purposes, when we are considering Brahman, it makes little difference to us whether we approach it from a Buddhist or Hindu point of view at this stage. That is, we are aiming towards shunyata. We are aiming to extricate ourselves from the attachments to our thought forms. And that oceanic concept of Brahman, which in the Upanishads they say, an ocean one, the seer becomes without duality. This is the highest path, the highest prize, the highest world, the highest bliss. It is that bliss of his on but a fraction of which other beings live. And in a Buddhist text describing the Buddha, it says, freed from form, sense perception, feeling, habitual tendencies, and consciousness, he is deep, incommensurable, unfathomable, like the great ocean. And since any label of Brahman is wrong, any attribution of any form is wrong, even to the concept of void or empty. In that sense, it is gone, 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 gone beyond, completely gone beyond the concept of beyond. And here again is the third Chinese patriarch to again show another facet of the Brahman. Because you can come at this through Southern Buddhism, you can come at it through Tibetan Buddhism, you can come at it through Chinese Zen, through Japanese Zen, through Hinduism. It is where the transformation has occurred. And all we can do is point at it or become it. For the unified mind in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases. Doubts and irresolution vanish. And life in true faith is possible. With a single stroke, we are freed from bondage. Nothing clings to us, and we hold to nothing. All is empty, clear, self-illuminating, self-illuminating. With no exertion of the mind's power, you don't have to do anything to see it. Here, thought, feeling, knowledge, and imagination are of no value. All the things you did to get there are meaningless once you're there, or here, or not there, or here. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self. To come directly into harmony with this reality, just say when doubts arise, not to. In this not to, nothing is separate. Nothing is excluded, no matter when or where. Enlightenment means entering this truth, and this truth is beyond extension or diminution in time or space. In it, a single thought is 10,000 years. Emptiness here, emptiness there, but the infinite universe stands always before your eyes. Infinitely large, infinitely small. No difference, for definitions have vanished and no boundaries are seen. So too with being and non-being. Don't waste time in doubts and arguments that have nothing to do with this. One thing, all things move among and intermingle without distinction. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this faith is the road to non-duality. Non-duality is one with a trusting mind. Words. The way is beyond language, for in it there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. One of the qualities of the Brahman is the quality of omniscience. The way I've worked with the concept of the Brahman, just conceptually, on a physics level, is to assume that as you go into smaller and smaller units of energy, seems like the air, or seems like Mars, or seems like this carpet, all turn into tiny units of energy. We're doing a metaphor now, and it's risky because it implies entityness, but we'll work with it. And you get down to these tiniest somethings of energy, which, as you remember in the Oppenheimer quote, you can't say that they're either this or that, but there is some patterning or something of energy. And everything in the universe is made up of the same stuff. And it's all interchangeable at every moment. And it's all totally interrelated. It's like a solid mass, if you will. Although that sounds very entityness. Careful. Just use it as an analogy. But it has a one solid quality about it. And when you are not attached to being a separate part of it, you are part of it all. And at that part, all is known to you subjectively, and you are everywhere at once, because you are no longer in a time-space fix. Everything that I have experienced in any of my inner work, and everything that I have understood from my gurus continually saying to me, sub-ek, it's all one, sub-ek. Don't you see it's all one, Ramdas? And all of my studies of the literature have reinforced and supported this feeling of the interrelatedness and the omniscience and omnipotence and integrity of that which lies behind form. And it's interesting that in reading Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, there is hardly one thing in this book that I disagree with. It all feels right on to me. In fact, it feels right on in one of the clearest exegesis I've ever read. But there is one question. Question is, is an enlightened person omniscient? And Trungpa answered, I am afraid this is a mistaken conclusion drawn from the Yogacharan one mind theory, a theory which has also appeared in other religious and philosophical traditions. The idea is that an enlightened person has become the one mind and so knows everything that ever was, is, or could be. You always get this kind of wild speculation when people involve themselves with mystery, the unknowable. But I am afraid there is really no such thing as the one mind. I thought you'd enjoy that. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, all Buddhas of past and present, Buddhas of future time, using this Prajna wisdom, come to full and perfect vision. Now, just in case it all seems too Eastern in flavor, let me just read you a few quotes from Franklin Merrill Wolfe. He is an interesting American scientist type. I was first turned on to him by a lawyer in Washington, and then I found out that he was a very close associate of John Lilly's when I was visiting John. He lives up in Lone Star, California, in a little cabin with his wife. He's about 80 now. And these experiences happened to him in 1937. The event came after retiring. He had been doing a lot of meditation. I became aware of a deepening effect in consciousness that presently acquired or manifested a dominant emotional quality. It was a state of utter satisfaction. But here there enters a strange and almost weird feature. Language, considered as standing in a representative relationship to something other than the terms of language, ceased to have any validity at this level of consciousness. In a sense, the words and that which they mean are interblended in a kind of identity. The relative theories just didn't apply at this level. So satisfaction, and quote, the state of satisfaction, possess a substantial and largely inexpressible quality. This state of satisfaction was a kind of integration of all previous values, the culminating fulfillment of desires. One can desire only when there is some sense of lack or an incompleteness, what needs to be fulfilled, or a goal that needs to be attained. When in every conceivable or felt sense all is attained, desire simply has to drop out. The result is profound balance in consciousness.
Gradually, the satisfaction faded into the background and by insensible gradation became transformed into a state of indifference. While within this state, I recalled the basis of my previous motivations and realized that if this state had been outlined to me then as an abstract idea, it would not have seemed very attractive. But while fused with the state, all other states that could formerly have been objects of desire seemed flaccid by comparison. The highest conceivable human aspiration envisages a goal inevitably marred by the effects of immature imagination. As an intimate part of that supernal consciousness, there is a sense of power and authority, literally of cosmic proportions. I got a sense of that one day when I was sitting with my guru, and Indira Gandhi went by with her generals and jeeps and whole business. We knew she was in town and going around. And Maharaji said to me, just this old man sitting on a wooden table with a blanket wrapped around him, look at all that. And it's just a worldly king. Can you imagine all that? And that's, it's only that much power? I mean, it isn't even the real thing. It isn't even the real power. By contrast, the marchings of the Caesars and the conquests of science are but the games of children, says Merrill Wolfe. For these achievements, which seem so portentous and commanding upon the pages of human history, all inhere in a field of consciousness that in its very roots is subject to that higher power and authority. I found myself spreading everywhere and identical with a kind of space that embraced not merely the visible forms and worlds, but all modes and qualities of consciousness as well. However, all these are not there as disparate and objective existences. They are blended, as it were, in a sort of primordial and culminating totality. That the secular universe vanished, and in its place there remained none other than the living and all-enveloping presence of divinity itself. Merrill Wolfe, Philosophy of Consciousness Without an Object, it's called. Now, lest all of you feel this is all just too abstract and irrelevant for your life, let me say that the only way that any of that will take on, any of those bones will take on flesh, is through your own experiences. It will never be gratifying just to hear about it. But what the hearing about it may do when you open to it is resonate within you in a place where you sense the validity of your identity with something other than what you, quote, think you are. And that sense is what gives one, quote, faith to undertake all of the methods of yoga, to fight the battle of Kurukshetra. It's right at that place that the faith is generated. It's an incredible panoramic view of all form, both physical plane, astral, causal, all the conceptual, all levels of form, even way back to the pure idea. All of it folds back in into that which is unnameable, unknowable, immeasurable, indefinable, and yet is. You will have many experiences. Some of them will only be like the experience of emptiness. That isn't it, because no place is it. No experience is it. But it is the presence of all paradox, of all polarities, of all opposites. At that point, time has stopped. Past, present, and future all are right here. All are right here. So there is freedom from time and space. And that kind of freedom is reflected, for example, in Kabir saying, I shall not come and I shall not go. I shall drink nectar with my guru. One turns a tasba, another turns a mala, but see, O people, they're both professionals. One goes to Mecca, one goes to Kashi, but both have nooses around their necks. Listen, O people, Kabir says, I am of no one, no one is mine. Now we're talking about freedom. We're really starting to talk about what the freedom is of this journey. The freedom from models, the freedom from standing anywhere, the freedom from limited view, the freedom from limited sensation. I am in the world, but I am not a subordinate of the world. That means you have transcended the gunas, the forces of nature, the strands of rope that create nature. I have passed through the market. I am not a purchaser. I have passed through the market. I am not a purchaser. Nothing does it to me anymore. Were the Gita to stop at this point, I think that the Buddhist influence on the Gita would be the dominant theme of the Gita. And what we've done is now seen the higher wisdom that is expressed up through chapter 6, roughly. But the Gita suggests a whole other type of wisdom. See, there is a predicament that the Buddhists talk about in terms of the Bodhisattva. And the predicament is that everybody, you'd figure if you went back into the Brahman and merged totally into it, would there be anything doing? Would anything ever be done? Would there be any form? Would there be any manifestation? Would there be any avatars? Would there be any bodhisattvas? What would they do? Where would the law be? Isn't the law under this state? And if it's under this state and you've transcended all law, why would you do dharmic things anymore? Why would it keep saying that beings who rest in the Brahman become the Dharma itself with a capital D, not a little d? Who are these beings that roam around free, yet apparently continuing to manifest? What Krishna says to Arjuna is, until you're quieted down, until your mind is completely cooled out, until your purification exercises are all over, until you are residing in the Brahman, you won't even begin to recognize me. And what Krishna is suggesting is that beyond both that which is without form and that which is form, behind both Purush and Prakrit, behind the Brahman and the Shakti, there is still some other There is still the Dharma. There is still law. There is a directionality. You see, if you notice in the Gita, Krishna keeps saying over and over again, look, whichever you pray to, you're going to get. If you pray to the lesser god, say you pray to the god of drink, you'll become a drunk. If you pray to the goddess of wealth, you'll probably become rich sooner or later in one incarnation or another. If you pray to the void, you will become void. I mean, it's an interesting question in Hinduism. I won't get into debating it on the level of Buddhism, but in Hinduism, there are some beings who go into what's called nirvikalpa samadhi, samadhi without form. And after, Maharaji said 43 days, but I've also heard of 21 days. I'm not quite sure about it. After so many days of being merged into that, the body disintegrates and it just falls apart because there's nobody in there keeping it together. There are other beings who still have more karma to do. Their attachments bring them right back and they've just touched the possibility of it. I think many people in this room have done that. There are others who go into it, reside in it, and yet the manifestation continues, but it is the manifestation of the Brahman coming through a form. It's like nobody came back, but yet there is something there. What that space is, and how that is manifest, what those beings look like, for example, are beings of crazy wisdom. That's what one would look like. There are no more rules in the game for such a being, because the compassion is all-embracing. The compassion comes out of total consciousness. And so that any of our models of you shouldn't do that because that's bad come out of our limited perspective. And when you're in the presence of one of these beings, when you sense the presence of such a being, you tend to more adopt the role of openness to the possibility rather than to judgment. Trungpa talks about crazy wisdom as outrageous wisdom devoid of self and the common sense of literal thinking. Certainly sounds like the Brahman thus far. Crazy Wisdom is wild. In fact, it is the first attempt to express the dynamics of the final spiritual stage of a bodhisattva. To step out with nakedness of mind, unconditioned, beyond conceptualization. In this state, one acts purely on what is, with the qualities of earth, water, fire, space, and stormy air. In Hakuin's Zen poem, beautiful Zen poem, we used to recite every morning at 4 in the Zen temple in Kyoto. Part of it says, if we turn inward and prove our true nature, capital T, capital N, that true self is no self, meaning there's no finite thing, our own self is no self, we go beyond ego and past clever words. Then the gate to the oneness of cause and effect is thrown open. Not two and not three, straight ahead runs the way. Now our form is no form, so in coming and going we never leave home. Now our thought is no thought, so our dancing and songs are the voice of the Dharma. So our dancing and songs are the voice of the Dharma. So our dancing and songs are the voice of Krishna. So our dancing and song, which comes out of our perception, which resides in the place beyond perception, is that of a true harmonizing with the divine law that incorporates form and formlessness, that incorporates all conceptual possibilities. So now we have a whole new meaning of karma yoga, because before karma yoga was doing something from within your karmic predicament to bring you to the One. Once you reside in the One, you come into a relationship with law such that all actions henceforth are themselves the pure statement of Dharma, because you have transcended guna, you are near guna, you are beyond the attachment to the strands of nature that bind. So that a being who is residing in the Brahman and who may be doing something every day is qualitatively an entirely different entity than everybody else who you are seeing, because there is nobody there. And that is one of the awesome and exasperating qualities of being around beings who you have the grace to come in contact with, who, as far as you can see, like with my guru in 1967, November, until this point, thought about him, studied him, reflected him, analyzed him, I can't find anybody there. I keep projecting into him there'll be another person, because there's a flesh and blood body there. And as it walks and it talks and it smiles and it laughs and it does all this stuff. But when I look into those eyes, or I reside in that heart, or I quiet down and meditate on the form, or I go towards that guru, it's like I am going into vast emptiness. Questions? The question was, how would the black hole that is appearing in astronomical research now relate to what we're talking about? Without a very sophisticated knowledge of what is being found out, my sense is that everything we will approach through our physical universe and our rational mind will always be limited. And that what black hole we are talking about, which is neither black nor light, is still qualitatively different than what that is about. Because behind this universe lie other universes, just as solar systems within, etc., etc. And all of that is as nothing in this game. This is what is so bizarre about it. It's only when you've been steeping yourself in, like Hindu literature, where the time units, as I mentioned, are things like 4 million years, that you begin to realize you're getting interesting with man's mind when you get to the black hole, but it feels still very short of the mark in a qualitative sense. I recall my guru saying, "You went to Mars, I understand. You're going to Mars soon, I understand." It's that everything you think you can do is just what you think you can do. And it's what Merrill Wolf was implying, that even the greatest things that man thinks he does, the adventure of going beyond the mind is so awesome. I used to think about the going to the moon and the relationship to that. By comparison, it is beautiful and awesome about man's mind, but it is really quite relatively trivial. And in a way, from that space of the Brahman, you can feel that all forms are the dance, including everything that man's mind has ever conceived of. I know that isn't a satisfactory answer. It's the best I can do for you at the moment. Questions? The question was, what is the difference between detachment from emotions and suppressing emotions? From the outside, it may not look phenotypically different. Genotypically, it's motivated in an entirely different way. To the extent that you attempt to detach yourself from desires or emotional concomitants of desires that still have a great deal of investment in them, and that the reason you are pulling back from them is because of the fear that you cannot have gratification of them. That is a defense mechanism. It is dissociation in the service of defense. To the extent that you are detaching, not because you have not had gratification enough, but because you have had gratification enough, that is exactly the opposite condition. You have arrived at the place where what Hinduism is called vairagya, the falling away of desire. It just isn't there. It's like you had children toys. And then as you grew up, you stopped wanting to play with those toys. Not because you hadn't had enough playing with them, but because you had enough playing with them, if you will. That is a qualitatively different genesis for the same behavior phenotypically of stopping something. To the extent that it forces, it has in it, it gets very close, but the forcing may be conscious in relation to a higher thing or something else you want, or it may be related to pushing away something you haven't had enough of. And I think that we ought to be sophisticated enough and able to consider the differentiation between those two things without being forced into seeing, as a psychologist would be inclined to see, all suppressing or repressing of behavior as in some way related to defense, because that's only one way of interpreting behavior. It's an interpretive difference. And only an individual really knows what they're doing, actually. And it becomes apparent what you're doing after a while if you try doing it thinking you're doing one when you're really doing the other, because the rules don't fall into place. Can I relate the origin of karma to the fall of man? The fall of man out of the heavens of the Garden of Eden, from the astral plane to the physical plane, from a high astral plane at which one experienced blissful heavenly states, is all within karma. That isn't the origin of karma. Karma was long before that. That's already the karma of Adam too, you know, and Eve and the serpent, and they're just living out their trips. It's already well behind that one. This is back in the beginning God created that place. That's getting close, right? And that isn't in time, so the whole thing's a hype. Question. See, the question is, he asked, what about the statement, "Thou shalt not kill," in the Bible, and Arjuna, and all of this? In Yama, the first of the purification components of Raja Yoga, which underlies the Gita, because it's assumed that Arjuna is already Satwig, and we aren't, so that a lot of stuff that's assumed in the Gita we have to look at. And one of them is non-killing. It's non-killing, non-stealing, non-lying, non-lusting, non-giving and receiving. It's called ahimsa, or non-killing. And I was just the other day reading Mahatma Gandhi's version of the Bhagavad Gita. Gandhi said, at the time the Gita was written, The people were well schooled in ahimsa, in non-killing, and they saw no contradiction between that and the fact that Arjuna was a kshatriya who warred for the Dharma. That's interesting. You've got to go a long way to figure out what consciousness people could be in to appreciate that, to bring those two things together and not see them as opposites and incompatible. Gandhi then goes on to say, in all my years of working with Gita and living by the Gita, I still feel that I cannot justify killing anything. My appreciation of the predicament is, and this is very fierce, but I will just say it the way it appears, is that Gandhi is basically not a mystic. Gandhi is a man of social action. He's a very humanitarian, good man of social action. Krishna is somebody who has the compassion that resides in the Brahman. It is not the compassion of mortal man who fears his own death. And the compassion that is one with the way in which the universe is created, survives, and is destroyed is a compassion which transcends the compassion that a man's mind can comprehend. And it is not at all inconceivable to me, just as a surgeon could perform an operation and create pain in order to alleviate suffering, that death, because as I understand it, Shiva, who is often identified in one of his aspects as connected with destruction, destroys that which is destructible. It destroys the Maya. It destroys the false wisdom. And from what we've been talking about, the separate self is false wisdom. And therefore, it would behoove Krishna to create a model for the destruction of that illusion of separate self, which any human being still identified to their separate self would be horrified by. So what I'm saying to you is that we are confronted most intimately in this issue of ahimsa with the two levels of wisdom. And I think what we always can come back to is that as long as we are beings with a limited view of the universe, we act in accordance with the highest morality we understand, and that morality would be not killing. But we must allow for the possibility that we don't know it all, and that there is a way of understanding in which the compassionate thing would be the killing of another sentient being. And that is totally comfortable for me. I hope it is for you. Yeah. The question was, how do I relate eternality to the Buddhist idea of there not being any eternal thing? I said before that from our point of view, from where we're starting from, it is perfectly reasonable moving towards or away from any attachment to anything, including the idea that anything is eternal. That's a perfectly reasonable strategy from where we're sitting. It may turn out that when, through that strategy, one enters into or falls out of all of the states that our minds have thus far defined, would be another way of saying it, you may find, or what is, that there indeed is this form which lies behind it. It's really none of our business at this point. I mean, it isn't our work. Our work is to do a lot of stuff around here first. I mean, I don't think I could in good faith have Joseph teaching Abhidhamma and Satipatthana Vipassana as the meditation method in this course, which is certainly based not on an eternality view, if I felt that that was taking us away from something. But it seems to me that is merely opening up the field. And through that kind of meditation, what will be, will be. Now, we are going to be talking about entirely different methods than this, which are methods of bhakti or devotional yoga. And those devotional methods will be based on the teachings of the Gita in the sense that there is an eternal thing behind the formless, But even then, there is what would be called lower bhakti and higher bhakti. And as far as I'm concerned, the lower bhakti, which is starting from the space we're in, where you have thoughts and you have a heart and you have a body, from where you're starting from, there are a number of different ways you can go. I was just reading the biography, experiential biography of Swami Muktananda, called Chichakti Vilas, in which he's a Siddha Yoga, and his whole route through involved working with Chitta Shakti, working with energies, working with Kundalini. And if you read his descriptions of the states he was entering into, they are not dissimilar at all from the states that are described in the jhanas in Southern Buddhism. They are described again and again in every different system. You can start out just by working with your heart, with loving a projection, a limited thing, as we're going to talk about in devotional yoga. And it will still take you to the Brahman. And in the Brahman, then something else will emerge or won't emerge. Okay. You can go there any route you want at this point. You don't have to get into it's either this or that. You only have to intuitively grasp in your own being what feels right on for you. And you get to trust that. And it's not one route is higher or better or cleaner or more sure. Not historically it isn't. And you can't buy another person's trip. You got to do what you got to do. Everybody's got to go on the trip all by themselves. Yes. The question was, in Autobiography of the Yogi, it said that through Kriya Yoga you can go through something that would take many incarnations otherwise. It's all within karma, including the methods you adopt. And if you're going to get done in this incarnation, you'll get done because the methods that'll get you done will attract you. And if you're attracted to a method because you want to get done in this incarnation just because of your greed, but it turns out that you got about 5 more incarnations to go, you can use Kriya Yoga till hell freezes over and you won't get there, right? A bhakti can love God so purely that in 1 second the whole thing can be over. When you're ready, you sit down and go into meditation and you'll go right through and through and through and you'll go through every stage of preparation for Buddhahood, just like brrr, like that. Nothing will hold you back except your karma. No methods really hold you back that much. Every method that we're talking about brought somebody there sometime or other, right? That's all we know from where we're sitting. And then it gets into who's most persuasive and who gives the best come on, you know. We'll take you through painlessly, see? Or we'll take you through soonest, or we'll take you through most tough-mindedly and cynically, or we'll take you through most lovingly, you know. It's all just come-ons. It's all come-ons. The thing is to be open to all the methods and hear what feels and try a little of this and a little of that and you'll hear. You can't buy somebody else's model. Like, Trungpa can sit up and he can write a book about crazy wisdom and he can act crazy out of that place of crazy wisdom. But for the first 19 years of his life, he was doing incredible sadhana. He was so involved in spiritual materialism, it's absurd. Much more than anybody here is, you know. But then he finished with it, and he's saying, well, now I'm finished with it, and I'm telling you, don't get caught in it, right? And his method, because you use malas, and you use prostrations, and you use Kriya Yoga, and you use love of God, and you use sitting down and following in-breath and out-breath, and you use it all, and it's all materialism. It's all stuff you use to get done using stuff. And I can't see that any stuff's a hell of a lot better than any other stuff. It's all pretty stuffy. Okay. All you have been and seen and done and thought, not you, but I, says Krishna, have seen and been and wrought. Pilgrim, pilgrimage and road was but myself, towards myself and your arrival, but myself at my own door. Okay. That's from F. Scott Fitzgerald's translation of Sufi.